Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas is now in session pursuant to adjournment.
You may be seated. Chief Justice Phillips and Justice Garrett and Justice Doggett are out of the city and will not be here this morning to hear oral argument. However, they will participate in the deliberation of both of these cases that has been combined for argument. They'll have available to them the recording that will be made of or the oral presentation that have the briefs as well. We have two causes for submission this morning, 3135 Russell versus Russell and 3148 Weaver versus Lawrence. The parties have been advised that they have 20 minutes aside, and I believe they've already informed the marshal of how they're going to break up that time. We're ready to proceed with the argument of petitioners in these combined cases.
May it please the court, Mr. Willis Dugas and Mr. R.J. Hagan will present argument for petitioners. Mr. Dugas will open. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, I'm Willis Dugas representing Dame Lambie Russell. This is a case involving the interpretation of the Family Code, Section 1.91B. Wherein the legislature repealed the ability of the courts to infer a marriage from the living together and holding out. In our situation, we do not find any agreement. My client is a man who lived with seven women different times and sired 11 children. All of these children were cared for. They were given college educations, those who chose to attend college, and those who did not were financially provided for. In 1981, he married the appellee, and she decided that she wanted to backdate the marriage. Time in the 70s so that she could come in on some property that he had. He had invested in a hospital. Hospital was sold and he made a profit, and she was seeking to extend the marriage to the point where she would share in those proceeds. In any event, she was asked, from 1964 until the ceremonial marriage, did you feel you were married to James Russell? And she says, in my opinion, yes, I was. And again, on cross-examination, she was asked, all of these years, there's not one time he ever told you that you and he were married, or he has to marry you until you all went and got the marriage license. That's just the fact, isn't it? And she answered, I don't know. The doctor continued to live with other women, continued to sire other women. There is nothing in the statement of facts that would show that there was an agreement to be married as required by Article 1.91B.
Your contention is the only way that a common law marriage may now be established is by direct evidence?
Yes, sir.
And the legislature then, I assume you would argue, has somehow preempted the ability of the fact finder to draw inferences from the evidence. In this case, an inference of an ultimate fact issue of agreement.
That is correct. Yes, sir.
That's why, by repealing this provision, have they prevented any inference at all from the circumstances?
Well, the legislation or statute before that allowed the inferences.
And now it's silent.
And now it was repealed, and the legislature has spoken and said that you can't infer.
They didn't say you can't. They just don't say anything.
But you can look at it that way.
Well, isn't that the way we have to look at it?
Well, I think you have to look at it on what the legislature did. You have to look at the legislative history.
What does the history show?
The history showed that prior to 1989, it was permissible and type of language says. You could infer.
I understand basically that's what Fletcher said, but I'm inquiring about any legislative history. Are there any hearings? What was the purpose of the legislation? What was the purpose of taking it out?
The only thing I have, there's a Houston Law Review article that I ran across this week. It's volume 28, page 1131, where the author of the article says that she spoke to the author of the amendment who said it was her purpose to abolish common law marriage. I realize what that is worth, but it's in the Law Review article. The Law Review article itself says that by this action, the legislature intended to abolish common law marriage. There's no need for them anymore.
Well, they did not, in fact, abolish them. They just took the presumption that was there that you could assume an agreement. From circumstantial evidence, they just took that out. But they left. You got the elements of a non-ceremonial marriage in place.
Yes, sir. But
the holding out, the living together.
But people, ceremonial marriages, you have to go and agree that you're going to be married. Why should people with common law marriages be placed on a higher pedestal than people who go through the process? I think my time's up.
Are there any questions? Thank you, Counsel.
Good morning. May it please the Honorable Court. My name is R.J. Haygood. I'm from Grayson County. I'm here representing Ronald Kent Lorenzen. The case that we have before the court involves the same question, obviously, that whether or not there was an agreement by Ms. Weber and Mr. Lorenzen to be married. Our contention is that there is no evidence from the testimony that there was an agreement. The testimony indicated that the trial court found that they were married in 1982 in Illinois. That's contrary to the testimony given directly by her that she did not consider herself to be married in 1982. And the next question posed to Ms. Weber was...
Was this a ceremonial marriage in Illinois?
There was never a ceremonial marriage.
I mean, was there an allegation of a ceremonial marriage?
No, they began living together in Illinois, I think the record reflects, in 1982. The next question posed to Ms. Weber was, but at what point in time did you make the decision that you would become husband and wife? And she said, well, we just talked about it and thought that we didn't need to go through the formalities. And they discussed it periodically. She testified only that she felt or considered herself to be married. There's no evidence whatsoever where she says we had an agreement to be married. This is when it was made. This is the circumstances under which that agreement was made. This is what we did to celebrate. Nothing to indicate that there was an agreement, a meeting of the minds, if you will.
But you can infer an agreement from circumstances. That's well established.
Yes, sir. I think that you can. But
what circumstances do you think it would take to infer an agreement to marry?
Okay, first of all, let me be clear. In our case, there was no agreement. There are no testimony indicating that there was agreement or meeting of the minds. But at a minimum, I think that you have to have something to say, yes, we did agree. And then you can look at light of all the surrounding circumstances, the time when they made the agreement, where they were when they made the agreement, what their situation was when they made the agreement. Did they discuss property rights that agreement would affect? Did they talk about their family members, notifying them?
Typically in these cases, one party will say, yes, they agreed, and one party will say, no, they didn't. How can that be resolved?
Your Honor, I think that those type of questions in our courts are resolved every day by the trier of fact.
So the trier of fact resolved this one?
But there's no evidence, or there's insufficient evidence that there was ever an agreement. If there had been testimony before the court that said, yes, this what we had an agreement, we had a meeting of the mind that we were going to be husband and wife, then you can take into consideration maybe some of the other facts that you've asked me about.
What if parties cohabit and they hold themselves out as married, and the only evidence in the record is, honey, I'll never leave you. Can the trier of fact, is that some evidence of an agreement?
That would possibly be some evidence, but it seems to me that the question, it's just like a no-fault divorce. If we have testimony in our courts that say, well, I'm not happy with my spouse. That's not going to get you divorced. But if you start to track the language, this is the marriage coming before because of this court in conflict, that does it. It seems to me that it's such a simple thing to say, did you have an agreement? And then talk about under what circumstances that agreement was made to give us some guidelines and how specific that agreement has to be.
Mr. Hager, let me ask you this. Let's assume that agreements can be inferred by people's conduct. If Mrs. Weber had foregone some things she might have otherwise been able to do, someone else asked her to marry him, some other person, and she said, I'm sorry, I'm already married, or she had the occasion to take a job someplace else, but Mr. Lorenzen refused to let her have the job. Do you think that kind of evidence would rise to the level of what I'd call sort of a detrimental reliance on the understanding of marriage or something that would rise to the level of establishing an agreement?
Possibly, Your Honor. But again, what she feels or what she considers, it doesn't make it necessarily an agreement to be married. That might could be evidence that a trial court, maybe a finding of fact, could look at to see whether they had an agreement. But just because she felt one way doesn't necessarily...
I'm not talking about how she felt. I'm saying would you agree that if the evidence says that she changed her conduct in reliance on her understanding that they were married, not that he had said anything about it, but that she had, kind of analogizing to sort of a quantum merit sort of thing, she did something with the understanding that she'd receive something in exchange, that something being married. Do you think that is the type of evidence that could establish a marriage under this statute?
To me, that lends a greater credibility to what she says about the feeling that they had an agreement, yes.
What is an agreement to marry? Is that ceremonially marry or something less than that?
Something less than that. But still there has to be both people have to feel that they're going to love and honor and support the other one, just as if they were ceremonially married, I think.
But isn't the problem that one side's going to deny it? I mean, that's otherwise we wouldn't have a lawsuit.
That's true, but that happens every day, I know.
So we'd never be able to establish a meeting of the minds, I presume, at least by the testimony of the witness.
Well, you may not, but you can come closer to you can in this case where there was no testimony whatsoever that they had an agreement.
Did Mr. Lorenzen and Ms. Weber pull themselves out to be married, introduce themselves as married?
Your Honor,
evidence of that?
I don't think there is much evidence of that. The overwhelming evidence, I think that record indicates that they did not even hold themselves out to close friends that they intended to be married or were married. The correspondence that they received from friends who took care to write them addressed their letters to Ronald Lorenzen and Vivian Weber. The apartments were listed in different names. Income tax returns that she filed herself, the only year she was required to file, she filed as a single person.
Some married people do that.
Sure. But
how's that any evidence one way or the other?
The years he filed for income tax, he filed as single parent. There's a dependent listed only as a friend, not as a wife. But the even the friends who had written them and relatives who had written them addressed them individually, not Vivian and Ronald Lorenzen. Thank you.
We'll hear from respondent.
May I please the court, Mr. Ronald Alton, W. Isleton, and Mr. Jack Lawrence, who can argue for respondents. Mr. Isleton will open.
May it please this honorable court, the facts of this case are really fairly simple and certainly less intriguing than the Russell case, having read the decision from the Court of Appeals. Considering only the evidence and inferences tending to support the verdict of the trial judge in this particular case, which is certainly the standard that should be applied, Weber testified that she had a common law marriage to Mr. Lorenzen as of February the 16th, 1982, until their split in 1990, approximately 8 to 9 years. She considered the merit. They rented property in the state of Texas under the name of Lorenzen. and she was introduced to friends and co-workers in Texas as Ronald's wife. Utilities were the name
by
of Vivian Lawrence.
By Mr. Lawrence?
By Mr. Lawrence, and that's correct, Your Honor. Now, there is some conflict within the evidence as to exactly who was making the introduction. I think the assumption or the interpretation that you could very rightfully draw would be that it was Mr. Lawrence who was introducing to his friends in the transcript. She received receipts for community purchases. Ronald had suggested they have children, and he claimed Vivian on his income taxes as a dependent and claimed her travel expenses. On page 43, and the only reason I specifically point out this statement.
Maybe we're talking about two different income tax returns, but did I understand the other councilman to say that she was listed on income tax as friend?
She was, Your Honor. And
is that the same one that you're talking about?
Those are the same income tax returns, Your Honor. I would suggest to you that, as in Geisel, certainly the fact that someone is listed as single or as a friend on income taxes would not be determinative as a matter of law as of that status.
I don't think it would determine whether or not they're a friend, but it might determine whether or not they're something else.
Mr. Lawrence testified that he realized through his accountant that he could not claim her travel expenses or her deductions unless she was his spouse. And that's where I'm going with that.
But still he didn't say spouse.
He didn't say spouse. No, he did not say spouse.
So he was not claiming a marriage.
He was not claiming a marriage. But on page 43 of the statement of facts, Ronald is asked with regard to the relationship that existed between the two persons. He testifies, quote, "The question was, are you saying to the court that you never agreed to any sort of partnership between the two of you?" His answer was no, indicating that there must have been an agreement at some point in time. The trial court found that a marriage existed. The Court of Appeals reversed, indicating that there was no evidence of an agreement and concentrated solely upon the testimony that was subject to interpretation that was given by Mrs. Weber. I'll come to that testimony here in just a minute. I want to make one point, though, very, very clear. We're not dealing with a case here in which there is just circumstantial evidence or just an inference drawn from living together or holding out. We're dealing with a case, as in Claveria, where there was direct evidence of an agreement to be married, testimony by the purported spouse that she was married, and that direct evidence can carry over, I believe, into inferences and circumstances that corroborate that agreement on the part of that spouse.
Why wouldn't it be correct to say, Mr. Arnold, if they are married, the only way they are married is under this Part A2 of Section 1.91, which is they agreed to be married, and after the agreement, they lived together in the state of husband and wife, and they're represented to others that they were married. If they're married, that's the only way they are married, is under that Part 2.
That's correct. That's correct.
Okay. If that says that the element is that they agreed to be married, and then after the agreement, they lived together in this state as husband and wife, and they're represented to others that they were married, how do you say that you can establish the agreement by showing that they lived together as husband and wife and represent the others as husband and wife without eliminating the first part of that phrase entirely, the agreement to be married?
There, what I'm saying here is that there was direct evidence of an agreement to be married. Let me indicate that first. There was direct evidence of an agreement to be married. What Mrs. Weber testified to was, "We had discussed it and said it was just a piece of paper, you know, as far as going through the formalities, and decided not to." Now, that statement, we grant, is subject to interpretation. The way the trial judge apparently interpreted that testimony, and that's evidenced on page 85 of the statement of facts, wherein he said, "She agreed to be married. She must have agreed to be married because she indicated that any formal marriage would just be a piece of paper." That was the same position that the Shelton v. Belknap court took some time ago when they were trying to interpret the statement of what difference do it make about getting married by a preacher, et cetera, et cetera. There was an interpretation that could be placed upon her testimony. She said she considered herself married. What the trial judge apparently took from that, inferred from that particular statement, was she considered herself married because she had indeed agreed to be married at some point in time. I'm not indicating that that's the strongest direct evidence in the world, but I am indicating that because of all of those other corroborating facts that are within the statement of facts, all of which were totally overlooked by the Court of Appeals and deciding that no inference can be drawn, that all of those facts support her statement and the interpretation of her statement that she was married.
But so counsel, are you saying that the core, the central core of this direct evidence is this conversation where they discussed
she
marriage?
Indicates specifically
is that the core you're building the direct evidence around?
She indicates in two particular places. She says, number one, we had discussed it and said it was just a piece of paper as far as going through the formalities and decided not to. Number two, she indicates
that's her testimony talking about a discussion.
That's correct.
All right.
Then, granted, I indicated that that was subject to interpretation, and certainly the Court of Appeals should not, according to Poole versus Ford Motor Company, and insert their own interpretation into the trial court's interpretation of that evidence. Well, what I'm indicating is there was a ton of corroborative information
that would corroborate this conversation.
Exactly. Not the conversation.
Well, if everybody agreed that they had talked about it, would that be a direct evidence?
She says they talked about it and agreed that there was no reason for a formal ceremony. She goes on to say that she considered herself married. It's from that core that the judge could draw some direct evidence. Now, we must look at this in the most favorable light in terms of what the trial judge had in front of him. At that point in time, he interpreted that as an agreement. Granted, there are some problems with that, but when you bring in the other circumstantial evidence, where Maria tells us we can look at conduct, we can look at other facts that corroborate the agreement, then certainly it's not an open and shut case in terms of just looking at that statement and saying, that's too unclear, let's decide there was no agreement.
Well, among these other things that you say we need to look at to corroborate, is there any evidence of Mr. Lorenzen's agreement to be married?
Mr. Lorenzen specifically responds. When I ask him whether there was some sort of partnership, marriage partnership between the two, if there had never been a marriage partnership between them, he said no. And that indicates to me that there was a partnership at some point in time, or at least a trial.
Careful, let me understand. You say he said no.
He said.
But that indicates to you that there was?
The question was, has there never been an agreement or partnership between you? He said no. So it was a double negative there. Now, Mr. Lorenzen denies the agreement. Let me make that very clear. Mr. Lorenzen denies the agreement. As Professor McNye points out in Southwestern Law Journal in 1990, you're going to have two sets of facts in any kind of 191 case. One would be a situation where one party's dead and it's not there to deny the agreement. The other situation is where a party is going to indeed deny the agreement. And the only way that you can reasonably come to a decision, Mr. Haygood said the trial judge is responsible for that. They do it every day. Sincerely, they do, because they look at the totality of the evidence, the conduct elements that were discussed in Claveria, look at all the inferences they can draw, and certainly under 191, I also want to indicate my co-counsel will speak further to this, you can still draw those inferences from these facts that are set out in the statement of facts.
What is your authority for that statement when the legislature specifically removed the inference in this situation, when they deleted in 191, that you can draw an inference?
My authority for that statement is my understanding of how 191 came about in the first place. Humphreys versus Humphreys, the Shelton Court, those decisions came long before 191. They were codified into 191. 191 was simply a statement of what this court had already decided with regard to the ability of a trial judge to draw inferences. The losing counsel in Claveria was the one who was hurt the most by that particular section in 191, and the losing counsel in Claveria was Patricia Hill, who introduced the amendment to 191. We have very little legislative history. We've looked hard and long, but we know that the intent of what was proposed to the Senate after it's passed by a very small margin in the House was a bill that was not intended to destroy the inference.
One more question, counsel. You said that Mr. Lorenzen was denying all this
correct
all the time. but did he do anything that would be supportive of the fact that there was a marriage?
I would suggest three things, and these are all supported in case law. That he discussed with Mrs. Lawrence and the fact that he wanted to have children. Number two, they were living in a very traditional lifestyle. There are cases that there's a Waco case, Reed Standish case, which supports this, in which he went out and did all the work and she stayed home and took care of the house. That is also corroborative of the fact that there was an agreement to be married. And I go back again to these income tax returns. Keep in mind what his accountant said is you can't claim this person's expenses or travel expenses unless she's a spouse. He named her as single, he named her as a friend, but he claimed her expenses and travel expenses. May it please the court, I have to defer to my other counsel here.
May it please the court, my name is Jack Lawrence. I'm representing Mrs. Russell. I'm going to begin by correcting Mr. Dugas's briefs, both here and in the Court of Appeals, that Family Code Section 1.91A2 has never been repealed, and it still remains intact, just as do common law marriages. Section 1.91A2's elements would be reduced to a mere form of words if you could not imply a contract, an implied in fact contract, from what they attest to, which is the conduct of the parties.
Of course you can do that. Why are these circumstances, why do they tend to show an agreement to marry as opposed to just an agreement to live together? Why aren't they equally consistent?
Well, to answer your question two ways. In our case, we had direct evidence of a common law marriage between pages 48 and 52 of the Statement of Facts. She's asked twice whether or not there was an agreement. She says yes. She says twice that, in my opinion, there was an agreement. Then she's asked to give a specific time and place, and she says that I can't pinpoint that, and you know it. Finally, she says, I don't know, after she's been hounded for that over four pages of the Statement of Facts. Now, to answer your question as a legal question, going under the Spanish civil law system, and the sites are Curtin versus State, 238 Southwest 2nd, 191-192, and it cites Lawson versus Lawson as cited in the Dunphy case, the 1905 Texas Supreme Court.
Is it true that you cannot infer an agreement to marry from living together?
Well, under DiCuneo, Cuneo versus DiCuneo, the holding out is acknowledgement, and an implied in fact contract has assent as an element, and there's nothing that's a better example of assent than acknowledgement. And
if you can infer an agreement to marry from holding out, why do you need the third element, agreement to marry? Why don't you just prove holding out?
Well, as counsel has pointed out, what will happen in these cases is that one side is going to vehemently deny the agreement and one side is going to be vehemently trying to say there was an agreement.
My question to you is this.
Yes.
If one spouse tells the public, this is my spouse, if that's holding out.
Yes.
If you can infer an agreement to marry from that, why have the element agreement to marry?
Because traditionally common law marriages were a contract. Marriage was a contract that only had a symbolic consideration.
But there are no practical significance to an element agreed to marry if it can be proven by some other element in the case.
In Texas, in a Spanish civil law state, they all recognize putative common law marriages. And if, as long as there's a dispute over whether or not there was an agreement, if the spouse in good faith believes there was, then that eliminates the necessity of this inquiry. I mean, this court either has to, by this decision, this court may decide to overturn putative common law marriages under the Spanish civil law system.
So, won't a spouse always testify that they believed in good faith in this marriage? If that's what they're claiming?
I'm certain if that's what the claim is.
And the other side would say no.
Yes, sir. Now, in our case,
no way to solve it is decide who's lying.
It is service wearing that, Your Honor, the way this statute leaves things. Now, in our case, there was a 1981 formal marriage, which more or less put the law of the case into a pre-1981 era. And we don't think it's appropriate to apply a 1989 statute to a 1981 case.
Is living with other women inconsistent with an agreement to marry?
Is
living with other women inconsistent with an agreement to marry?
Under the case of Wheat versus Owens, 15 Texas reports, adultery is possible. It's whenever there's abandonment that the common law marriage ceases. There are other cases after Wheat, which I didn't cite Wheat in my briefs.
A common law marriage ceases on abandonment?
That's a misstatement of the law. The right to claim a gananciale share ceases under the gananciale system. As our cross point, which we have preserved to this point, notes, you do not have to be married in Texas to claim a share of the gananciale partnership. There was dicta in the Clotharia case at the beginning of Justice Pope's opinion about that. In our case, we also had a situation where no findings of fact or conclusions of law were filed, and therefore a petitioner must show that there was no theory which could support the judgment. Despite the holding of the Court of Appeals construing Section 1.91, appellant must still show there is no other theory which could support the trial judgment. There were several theories which could take our case, completely out of the operation of the statute. One is that the 1981 formal marriage following the common law marriage is a declaration which satisfies Family Code Section 1.91A1 and 1.92, so that revised Section 1.91B is not triggered. The law of the case must be determined by pre-1981 law. I've covered that. Hence, the agreement element can still be inferred under former Section 1.91B. Three, the common law marriage did not end but merged into the formal one, so revised 1.91B is again not triggered. Arguendo, even if Section 1.91B is retroactive, we still have a putative common law marriage because she has a good faith belief in the marriage. And she, under the Lawson and Green cases cited in my brief, she'll still be entitled to an equal half property division. The Hayworth division cited in my cross point can occur because it is outside the statute, since it only applies to the unmarried. And under the Ingersoll versus McWillie, if there's no statute regulating an area, then the common law applies. Grigsby versus Reed would basically sustain that point too. Grigsby versus Reed and Berger versus Kelly were both 1913 Supreme Court cases that were companion cases to Schwingel versus Kiefer cited by petitioner. And one of them, Berger versus Kirby, is very plain in stating that an implied common law marriage agreement is where the party's conduct with reference to the subject matter is such as to induce the belief in the minds of the contracting parties that they intend to do that which their acts indicate they have done. And you've had five Texas Supreme Court cases, including Berger versus Kirby since that time, Humphreys, Kalar versus Navarro, Texas Employers Insurance Association versus Elder.
We have not written on common law marriages since the amendment, since 1989.
That's correct, sir.
If the legislature wanted to limit proof of a common law marriage to direct evidence, is there any question in your mind that they have the power to do so?
There's no question in my mind that they can do so. The question in my mind is whether they have done so in this case.
If they haven't done so, what in the world was the reason for the change in the law to eliminate the inference?
Well, Joseph McKnight takes the position cited in both of respondents' briefs to the effect that all they did was repeal the ability to make a direct inference from the other two elements, and that now the other two elements are just circumstantial factors like children and In our case, 14 years of joint income tax return signed under oath, a judicial admission, a sworn answer that he was married to the petitioner at the time. I'm sorry, I see my time.
Well, let me ask you one final question. So if there's evidence of the appellate court or the trial court, the fact finder must look to see whether there's any other evidence other than of cohabitation or holding out, and if there is some other evidence, you say that the trial court may infer from that other evidence, evidence of an agreement.
Yes, that basically has been the situation since Texas Employers Insurance Association versus Elder, and it was continued by Claveria. Today, courts are looking at joint income tax returns. They're particularly...
Isn't that evidence of holding out?
That's a statement under oath. They also look at whether or not they have joint savings accounts or checking accounts, whether they purchased property and there were conveyances. But there was a joint... he redeeded the homestead to the respondent in this case. They now, under McKnight's position, all of these will be factors given equal weight, except for their probative force as they're introduced into the testimony.
Any further questions?
Thank you.
You're going to take a full time for rebuttal,
or
you're going to share the time?
If I could share the time, that would be great. May it please the court, in short rebuttal, in the Lorenzen and Weber case, we know, it may be unclear as to how specific an agreement has to be before the finder of fact concludes that there was indeed a marriage. But in our case, there is no evidence that there was an agreement.
Should the rule of when you can infer an agreement from conduct be any different in the marital context than it is generally?
Generally meaning a ceremonial marriage?
No, I mean you can infer a contract from circumstances as a general proposition.
Yeah.
Should that rule have any unique application to marriages?
Possibly not after there is testimony that there is, in fact, an agreement, and maybe specific testimony as to that agreement about when it occurred, where it occurred, if it was any type of special celebration took place, those type of things.
So can we apply the same rule to marriages we would apply in the commercial context or any other context?
After you have testimony that there is, in fact, an agreement, possibly, yeah.
If there, one of the individuals is deceased and we're... there's not going to be any rebuttal of the assertion by the surviving individual that, in fact, there was an agreement. You're saying as long as the surviving putative spouse says, yes, we had an agreement, it occurred on December 1st, 1942, that will establish a common law marriage?
I don't know how else to tell you to do it. I'm sorry I got back over, but I don't know how else to do it. I don't know how to say that.
I'm just wondering whether there's any rule of law that would prohibit that kind of testimony under those circumstances, or whether it...
I'm sorry, I'm not sure. In conclusion, we feel like the testimony indicates that her feeling as if she were married, considering herself to be married, does not meet the statutory mandate. The legislature passes, we feel, because there's so many unwed people living together, they've got to have at least an agreement before you look to the other elements. Thank you.
Very shortly, regardless of whether the trier of fact can conclude that he can infer an agreement, there is no agreement in this case. And the statute plainly says that one of the elements is, first, they agreed to be married. And then after the agreement, they lived together in this state as husband and wife, and they represented the others they were married. So there is a necessity to have that agreement, and the legislature's actions probably not as specific as they could have been, did eliminate the requirement for an input. So, as a member of the court said, why have an agreement if you can survive on living together and representing the other? The statute says it comes first. We submit that that's a basic requirement for any marriage, including a situation of this kind.
Thank you, John. That concludes the oral submission document of the court. The four ongoing copies are submitted in the briefs and oral argument. The marshal will attend the court.
Johnny, please rise. OEA, 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 John, Supreme Court of Texas, is now adjourned. Pursuant to call.